Hi, and welcome to our Doc Industry Podcast, season number 5. Here's your podcast about creative documentary and animated film industry. It's in collaboration with our dear friends, the Programmers of Color Collective and What's Up with Docs. A big shout out to our partners, supporters, and contributors. Check them out. And hey, it's good to have you here. Enjoy your conversation. Here is Doc Industry Podcast, season number 5.
Hello, everyone. My name is Toni Bell, and I'm the host and creator of the What's Up with Docs podcast. And I'd like to welcome you all to this special episode that I'm collaborating with Doc Leipzig. So today, we actually have two filmmakers who are working on a film called Searching for Nora, tentatively titled. We have with us Claudia Chavez and Christy Maledic-Janey. Thank you, ladies, for being here today.
Thank you so much. Thank you so
much. All right. So I'd just like to start off with just a brief introduction. So, and just getting into your own personal filmmaking journeys before we get into Searching for Nora. So Claudia, please tell us a little bit about yourself, like where you are from, and also what drew you into filmmaking?
Yeah, of course. Well, I am Claudia Chavez. I am a Peruvian producer, but now I'm based in Madrid, in Spain. I started doing films since like 2017, I think, because I ended in a workshop in San Antonio de los Baños in Cuba. And then I get my first chance to enter to this film world. So since then, I started working in fiction, but mostly in documentary. Yes. I enjoy making documentary and yeah, I'm working on that.
All right. So what do you enjoy most about making documentary films?
I think the process, because the process is very, very, very different. And the way you can connect with the people you work, not only with your subject, also with your crew. I think you can connect very differently. And also because the documentaries that I work are documentaries that have they address some issues about, for example, linguistic preservation, I don't know, like memory and just social justice. So I think that, I don't know, I feel I'm doing something important for my country, for my society, for my child, for... I don't know. And when I make documentary, I think I am doing something important, you know?
Yeah, that's really beautiful because I see documentary films as part of the establishment and recording of legacy. And like you said, history and memory. And with that, you know, documentary content creators and those of us who work on the other side of that supporting documentary content creators really have a obligation to the subjects that we take on. So like, thank you for saying that. And also I wanted to point out, this is one of your Nora connections. You attended in Cuba Escuela Internacional de Cine TV, which was founded by the protagonist of your film, Searching for Nora, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I have a funny story about him because I live in Mexico now and I'm taking Spanish classes. So part of the classes are, you know, conversation, but also learning Spanish grammar. And Spanish is not easy, y'all. Let me tell you, the indirect obliques and the reflexive verbs, like, oh my goodness, so many. But I was, my teacher was asking me about my favorite novels. And I mentioned 100 Years of Solitude, but I said in Spanish, 1,000 Years of Solitude. And I was like, oh, that was a long time. That's a whole different book. But yeah, so tell us about Escuela Internacional de Cine TV, because I just learned about it in your researching, interviewing the two of you. And like, what a powerful legacy. Like, so many filmmakers from the quote unquote Spanish diaspora and who are documentary creators have like gone to the school. So if you could tell us a little bit about that.
I think it's for me, and I think for everyone that goes to that school, it's a very incredible experience because you go to you don't go to La Habana, you go to San Antonio de los Baños. That is a very small town, like in a rural part of Cuba. So you are like in a retreat, and only you speak about film. You only watch films with different people from the world. And because there are not only students for Latin America, there's other students for Europe, Africa. And so I think for me, it like I felt that my life really, really changed after the school, because this is a small detail. Before I went to the school, I was making advertising. That's right, advertising. And I thought that I was, I don't know, I didn't felt that I was in the right place. But then I went to study to the school, and then I started working making films. So for me, it was a really moment, I don't know, like a milestone in my life, I think. So yeah, it was very, yeah, a great experience.
Great. Thank you. All right, Christine. So, for those folks who don't know, I was reading through your bio and I was wondering if you could just tell our audience, like, what is a media anthropologist and what is a sociocultural anthropologist? I know because I have a degree in visual anthropology. So, I was very happy to be with a fellow anthropologist. But yes, can you explain what those two terms are, or those two phrases are for our audience?
Yeah, sure. It's really exciting to be here, I have to say. Thank you for inviting us. Claudia and I have been working on this for so long together, and it's really nice to take a step back and kind of talk about status of things. So, anthropology at its core is studying and thinking about what makes us human, what makes people the same, what makes people different, and how we make meaning in our lives. So stories and storytelling is a really important piece of what how we create meaning in our lives. So when we apply that kind of anthropological view at media or visual areas, it's like, okay, how do those things kind of how do we activate them and use them and do them so that we make meaning and we tell important stories and we figure out who we are and how we see the world and we connect to each other. For me, it was kind of it just kind of flowed that as I moved towards anthropology, because I didn't start off studying anthropology. I didn't even know what it was when I was younger. But as I had some kind advisors, you know, kind of guiding me and saying, oh, those questions, those are being asked by a group of people called anthropologists, kind of guiding me towards that way of thinking and seeing the world. Then filmmaking kind of just was there because it's about stories and, you know, connecting and making meaning. And that's what I really love about documentary too.
Thank you. And tell us about your connection to Peru, because your bio said you have Peruvian siblings. So are you Peruvian?
I'm not Peruvian, but when I was 11, you know, right, it's that time where your world is already kind of changing from this maybe a smaller view to one that's a little bit broader. Right at that time, for me, it was changing, and at that very time, my parents adopted two siblings who are now part of our family, and this was in 1991 when there was a lot going on in Peru. And so it really, really broke open my kind of view of the world. And as I've grown up with them now, I just had so many questions about people and languages and objects and knowledge moving around. We're all moving around, you know? And we intersect in different ways, and there's all these histories behind that. And I just had so many questions. I ended up continuing to go to school and reading and talking to people and meeting and learning languages. And it kind of culminated in this PhD in anthropology. looking at social and cultural aspects in particular, but also languages and then, visual archives. So that's kind of what I dedicated a great part of my life to.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. And it's great that you mentioned languages because, and Claudia, you mentioned this as well, because in regards to activism, a lot of people aren't aware that language justice is a thing. There have been many films out there created by Indigenous communities that have been really creative, but also have been really beneficial in helping to preserve language, because there's something about once you get that in one screen, like it makes it reality and a more accessible. So I wanted to mention two films that I've seen from a few years back. There's a Hadiya film called Edge of the Knife, and it's based on the Hadiya are people in what we now know as like Northern Washington and Southern Canada. Northern Washington State and Southern Canada. And this film, The Edge of Night, is actually based on one of their myths. It is a very powerful film, so I encourage anybody out there to look at that, watch that. And then there's the film The Fast Runner, which is a Canadian film, very famous film. It was like probably one of the highest grossing films in Canada, I think in 2001 or something. But it was the first film that was in the Inuit language. Both of these films have been really instrumental in regards to preserving language. And now we have podcasts, and there are a lot of podcasts that are in various indigenous languages. So, Claudia and Christy, for our audience, can you talk a little bit about like what language justice is and what that means, particularly for folks in Peru, particularly indigenous communities in Peru?
I think when we talk about the preservation of an indigenous languages, you talk not only about a language, the language is like aligned with a culture and the culture with a worldview. It's an everything. It's not only a language. It's like I said, it's all a culture. So in Peru, for example, exists there's a lot of languages. In my case, I studied a little bit one language. The name is Quechua. I actually made a, I am making a film about the preservation of a language through dubbing. Yes. So I have the chance to learn a lot about it in this process. But it's very hard because in case in Peru, you don't have the support from the state for the preservation. You don't have it. Actually, in a lot of different regions, the kids in the school can speak their own languages. They only have to speak in Spanish because they don't have a law that said that you have to respect a mother tongue, So yes, it's hard, but we are trying, or there's some activists that are trying to became this for a lot of people was a shame to speak in their mother tongue, but a lot of activists want to change this shame in proud. So yeah, it's hard, and it's I think a long journey, but some people are trying to preserve it right now.
It's interesting because Claudia and I were both working on films that had very large language components before we met. So it was one of the things that brought us together. I made a short film in, I forget if it was 2013 or 2014, about a Quechua language activist in New York City. It highlighted this activist's personal struggle with carrying the stigma that Claudia just talked about for so many decades. Even while she was a mother, she didn't speak to her children in New York City in Quechua. And then she realizes later in life that, maybe she would have chosen a different different way to do that if she could do it again. And so she decides to have classes and teach her granddaughter and become more active in the Quechua speaking communities in New York City. So when we showed that film, we had so many events that Elva, the protagonist, and I did, we did it together. And it, as Claudia mentioned, the after you make a film, there's so much potential impact and connection that can happen after a film is made as well. And we really saw a lot of power in raising these concerns with a film, with a story, and then having a conversation afterwards where many people were able to connect, even if it wasn't about Quechua, it was about a different language, but they identified with the story and it helped people share and reflect and consider the role of language in our lives and when we speak it and what we can do to keep it strong.
It's very powerful. And then you have a podcast in Quechua, right, Christy? Tell us about it.
I helped start with a student group at NYU when I was in grad school there. We had a very strong student group that was also part of this Quechua activist community group. It was like lots of different kind of groups working together sometimes. So it was a very exciting time. I now live in Chicago, so I'm a bit more removed. But yeah, there was a podcast and the goal was, hey, oftentimes it's challenging when a language has a lot of stigma and not a lot of resources. It's challenging to find materials in it. It's challenging to find spaces where people feel comfortable to speak it, and even it's celebrated. And so as students, we started partnering with anyone in New York City, in or outside of the university, who wanted to try speaking it, even if it wasn't perfect. And we tried to create a safe place to celebrate it. And it was a really exciting project.
All right. So I can relate to so much of this, particularly as since moving to Mexico, even though I studied Spanish before, you know, it's different being here. There is almost like I'm dealing with like self-stigma, self-conscious, like particularly as I learn more grammar, you know, my brain knows, okay, I should be saying this way, but I don't quite remember how to say it the right way. So there's a self-stigma, but also particularly in the US where I'm from, there is like all types of cultural stigmas, like you mentioned. So I remember when I was in graduate school for my first master's in creative writing, I did this long forms poetry project on the Native American Geronimo, who's Chiricahua Apache, and actually went to the San Carlos Apache Reservation, which he wasn't San Carlos Apache, but went there as part of my research and was talking to one of the elders, and they actually have language, they teach Apache there, and they have schools for the young people. And he was probably in his 60s or so at the time. And his grandparents actually were able to keep him out of the residential school some way. I can't remember the story exactly, but I think they hid him. Like, it was really dramatic. And because of that, he was actually one of the few people in his generation who could actually speak Apache. Mm-hmm. But he did say a lot of the language was lost, as well as a lot of the culture, particularly a lot of the culture around like medicine and medicinal plants and things like that, has been lost because like those elders, when they, you know, their children, when they were sent to the residential schools, they weren't allowed to speak the language. And a lot of times when they came back home, they weren't able to communicate with their parents because they had been really terrorized into not speaking Apache, you know. And then also other ways that language justice has come up in my experience is, I worked as an impact producer on a film called The Translators, which is about young people who are from Central and South America who immigrated to the U.S. with their parents, who actually act as translators for their parents, like for everything. And the places where language justice comes up in that is that a lot of parents didn't realize, who don't speak English, didn't realize they actually, in California laws, codified that they could actually request translators for all these like government interactions. And then also as part of like medical care, they can request it, but a lot of times there aren't people there to fill those roles. So a lot of times these children are thrust into these roles of responsibilities in regards to being advocates for their parents. So like language justice is really important, and it's complex, and those of us, a lot of we all have our levels of responsibility in making sure that these languages are preserved, because when those languages are lost, I feel like it's a loss to society. It's like knowledge that we lose, that we are probably not even aware of. Sorry, going on a little rant right there, but like we're very, very passionate about this. Okay, so I wanted to kind of go veer a little bit, because both of you are mothers who are making documentary films. And before I came on, I mentioned that I did some impact work for the film Through the Night, which is a film by Loretta Limbel, which is about a 24-hour daycare in New Rochelle. But part of the impact campaign for that was we actually did a session with mothers who work as documentary filmmakers, and basically what that work-life balance is, and also how the industry needs to shift, because we have all kinds of people making documentary. So I just want both of you to kind of like tell us about your kids, and then also talk a little bit about like what it is like being a mom who docs.
Hard.
Period in a sentence.
Like you said, you have to try to find the balance between your family life and your financial stability and doing films that you really, really care. And so for me, as a Latin American filmmaker, it's very hard. But I don't know, when you work, I think, with the right people that can understand you. For me, working with Christy has been amazing because I feel that she really understands how it feels. And so we try to always make an effort to put our kids in our production. So yeah, maybe you want to explain a little bit more, Christy.
I want to hear more about that, putting the kids to work.
Yeah,
They are
well,
producers' assistants.
besides having some fantastic photos of the kids in the gear, we also like to, well, I'll say, Claudia's mom is also frequently part of our productions, because we kind of the five of us often go places together. And we stay in one place at night. And when Claudia and I go out and do our work, then Claudia's mom and sometimes Zeki's dad, my son, will, be with the kids. But we're not that far away, and we can come back, and we have all of those duties to do even when we're on a production trip. But we also, when we're not on production trips, this is Claudia and I have come up with a kind of an amazing daily routine, because we also work, in order to do a project like Searching for Nora that we love so much and we truly believe in, we have to also have our families and support ourselves and our kids. We're the primary caregivers for our children. We have other jobs, and then we have the film, and then we have our kids. So, for example, Claudia lives in Spain right now, and I live in Chicago right now. So every day, my son gets up at 6:30, I get up at 5, and Claudia and I have a production meeting every morning during her lunchtime, when her daughter's at school, and when my son is still sleeping. And we focus, and we get everything done we need to in the day. And at other times when we don't meet, those are work sessions. And it requires us to be disciplined and stay on track and never lose focus. And now we've been doing this for years. But it works. And it works. We just find a way to make it work.
Make it happen. That sounds great. Thank you. Thank you. All right. So let's get into a little bit about Peru and like filmmaking in Peru, because your audience is from all over the world. Filmmaking in different countries is very different as far as the logistics, the funding, the distribution cycle. So can you tell us a little bit about what it's like making a film in Peru? And our gracious producer also wanted me to ask you about 50 years of national film law in Peru. So if y'all could speak to that, that'd be great.
How is making films in Peru? It's very you have to be very patient. But you normally have to make it with national funding and also with co-production from other countries from the region or other regions. Normally what happens is you go for the fund in Peru from the government. And then you can go to other funding that maybe Ibermedia. I don't know if you know something about it. Ibermedia, it's a Latin Ibero-American fund for co-productions between Ibero-American countries. So that's the way. But this year, I don't know if you know something about the political situation in Peru, but it's very, very, very hard. We have now a president that lives like in other planets because the economic and the security, and there's actually tomorrow there's how you say a strike,
Oh,
like
a strike, yes.
yeah, strike and a national strike because there's a lot of murders. It's very hard, but in the film area, and the Congress decide to eliminate the film law.
Wow. Okay.
That
Okay.
happened
So,
this year.
wow. So, what does that mean for filmmakers in Peru?
That means that we don't know if maybe next year we are going to have funds for a start. And then they want to make a really strange and bad new law. That censorship a lot of different topics that the state don't want to allow that tell or that go against the values of the state. So they don't want that nobody talks about, I don't know, the story of Rome or the LGBTQ stories also. So it's a very difficult moment right now for the film. I don't want to say industry because Peru don't have a film industry, but for the filmmakers in Peru.
So the filmmakers are highly dependent on this
Totally.
national
Yes,
and
totally, because it's not only funding for making films, it's also for distribution, also for if I want to go to study film in other country, you can apply to a fund for that, you know. So it's not
and
only for production, it's for a
so is
lot of
that
things.
how you that is that how you went to Cuba to go to school through this film
No,
fund?
but
Okay.
it's how I went to, I came to Spain because I studied here audiovisual distribution. Yes,
Okay.
with a fund from government, but
So
like I
what's the what is the reasoning behind eliminating this national film law? Because I feel like this would be the equivalent of in the US if they got rid of the National Endowment for humanities, you know, because not a lot of filmmakers get a lot of money, but a significant number do from that. But this seems like the equivalent. But this National Film Law in Peru seems to do a lot more for filmmakers. So what is the reasoning behind wanting to get rid of it?
The reason behind is that there are several films that show another point of view that what happened in Peru, for example, in the 80s, when we have a civil war in Peru. And if you try to talk about it or criticize it, how the government act on that time, you are a terrorist. And for the Congress, most of them from the right and says that no, you can't talk about it because you're a terrorist and you want to create terror. And yes, it's crazy, but it's how it works in Peru. So Actually, it's for that reason. Oh, when someone makes a film, a fiction or documentary about the LGBT community, it's like why they fund that kind of stories. Yes, so that's the reason behind that. It's not for me. It's insane because the film have to give you other like tools, like a viewer have to give you like the opportunity to question, right? So yes.
So the national strike is happening tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yes.
Yeah. So is that like all the workers are just gonna stop working for the day or?
Yes, actually, a lot of universities and I don't know, restaurants are closed tomorrow because it's a very difficult situation. Sometimes it's very insecure. The last year, we have another strike, and the government used the police to put order and kill 60 people.
Wow.
It's very insecure to go to a strike, but the people is, yeah, I don't know, like sick of everything. It's insecure, but the people is going to is going to do it.
Christy, did you want to add anything to that?
Just to give a little more details, we did apply to the Peruvian Film Fund because this is a co-production. Claudia and I are co-producing everything and we're co-directing everything. And we have some funds from the United States, but we are applying to the film fund this year, and we're waiting right now. Even though they dissolved the film law in the summer, we were able to apply, and it looks like this year will still go through. We don't know if we will win a funding there, but when we were just filming in August, we were filming with Nora because the International Film Festival of Lima was dedicated to Nora this year in August. And so we went to film her at this great event, and we were there to honor her. And we were also there to film with some of her colleagues and some other people. But at the film festival, at the inauguration, someone from the Ministry of Culture came and spoke, and it was a very contentious event. It turned into just a real moment when you could the idea of censorship, the fact that this is coming up again, that people will not be able to have free expression around certain periods of time in Peruvian history or certain perspectives from within the country. They're eliminating more funds from outside of Lima. So this will affect people of indigenous languages and from, other diverse perspectives. There's a lot of potential issues with what they're proposing to do. And so when we were filming, actually, it influenced what we filmed because the people that we were filming with we were talking about the first film law in 1973 in our film. But here we are, we all just went to this inaugural event. And they're thinking back, are we going to have censorship again now? Really? 51 years later, it connected with our film in this unfortunately very powerful way. And it really influenced what we filmed. So it's a much larger moment than our piece of it, but it was very significant for us and for our film production.
So, do you think the people that you were talking to were actually censoring themselves in regards to what they were saying to you?
No, I don't think
Okay,
so.
well, that's good.
Yes,
Okay.
they were in like in a safe zone with us, so no, not at all.
No, I think that they, but it, I think that it informed their messaging and what they wanted to share. But just like Nora also spoke to this in her event, just as fierce as ever. Nora is a very strong, eloquent woman, and she was speaking with the same fierceness during the event about this, you know, and which we filmed, and her colleagues. You know, these are people who needed to be very strong in the 70s, and they're still strong now. So it was a very, it just felt very significant, everything that happened in August.
Well, with that, let's get into like who Nora was. And I also would like you both to speak to, since we've already gotten on this topic of censorship, like what she went through in the 1970s as we're coming around this unfortunate full circle moment.
Well, Nora was the first is the first female director in Peru. She was the daughter of, she was part of like the elite of Lima in that moment. But she has a, when we talked with her, she said to us something beautiful, that it was that her life started when she divorced, because when she divorced, she knew what was making films, so she started doing it with her four children in the 70s.
Yes. She was mom and docking very early on.
Yes, so she started working with fiction actually, but she always said that it was documentary that she fell in love. And her third film was Runan Kaiku. And it was a film about the agrarian reform in Peru that affect a lot to the indigenous people, not only for the government in that period, but also for the elite also in Lima that treat the indigenous people like animals actually. And Nora showed that in her film. So for that reason, the film got banned.
Because she was showing the truth.
Exactly. Yeah. And the dictatorship said, like, no, you can't. You can't do that.
So she was she her Runan Kaiku was the first co-production between Peru and Cuba, we believe. We believe. Even if it wasn't the first, it was an early one. And she actually edited it in Cuba. So she filmed it in Cusco. First, she built a very strong relationship with the protagonist, Saturnino Wilca. He lived in her home for months, and they recorded. They had a translator because he spoke Quechua and she spoke Spanish. They became very close, and they aligned on what they wanted to do with the film. And then they filmed it, and then she selectively showed what she thought the military dictatorship would approve.
And then she did a bait and switch.
Yeah, and she was like, oh, innocent me, what would I make a film of, you know? And then she took it to Cuba, and she worked with a woman, a Cuban woman editor, who unfortunately has passed away, and edited the film that she believed that Saturnino and Nora wanted to make. And then they found out about it. She came back and showed it, and they were like, you can't show this. No way. And she said, oops, sorry, I already sent it to Doc Leipzig, actually. And
Oops.
oops, it's already on a plane. And like days later, it won an award at Doc Leipzig. And she sent it a couple other places as well. And so even though it was banned in Peru, it started to gain attention. And then she showed it in Mexico, actually, in Mexico City. And from that showing, she was invited into the committee of Latin American filmmakers.
Wow, that's powerful. That's powerful. Yeah, because when I so when the censorship that she faced, did the government of Peru ever come around after they saw the film was getting recognized?
I don't think so. I don't think
Mm.
so, because the first screening, I think I'm going to make a spoiler, but the first screening of the film was the last year, because this film and get lost, the original reels get lost in the world. So we were trying to search for them, and then we find them in Venezuela, and then we digitize. I hate that word in English. It's very difficult for me. I speak Spanish. And then we had a screening last year with Nora and Saturnino's daughter also. So it was a great and emotional event.
So where did that screening happen? Did it happen in Peru?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
Well,
In the Lima Film Festival.
so okay. So tell me about this hunt for archives, because one of my I got into documentaries, doing archival research. So it was another reason why I was very excited to have this conversation. And I have been on a hunt for many types of archives over the years. So tell me about like what that process was to try to find those original reels, and then that feeling of discovery, you realize you found it.
I will say that from a, Claudia can speak more to specific film archives, but for my PhD work, I spent many years working on photographic archives and reading about archives and thinking about them. And there's a many people who have written about archives questioning, what do we think of when we think of an archive? Is it really this big formal building with everything organized, and we go there and we find what we need, and then we know what happened, and it has some kind of truth in it? Or maybe we need to rethink it, because that shoebox of stuff that's shoved underneath someone's bed that's been there for 40 years, that's also an archive.
That's
And
right.
it may be dusty and it may not be organized and things may be broken, but it may help you generate something, right? And even if there's nothing there, the silences of archives, the gaps and the things that we threw out are just as important as those things that have been saved. And we also have to think about the voices, because some voices were recorded over others. And there again, there may be gaps and silences and whispers that we need to put a little more effort into to recover and fill the silences. So we very much took all of that with us on our searches, which is why when we go filming, we're not just in formal archives, where we go to Saturnino's old house and we go to his, the other town where his friend lived, and these places, and we go to the big archives. We searched all over, and we thought we were never going to find it, and it would be a commentary on the silences of archives. We really thought that was precisely it. And then we found it. So
Hey. And so what condition was it in?
actually, it was in a very good
Oh,
condition.
wow.
Yes, it
Because we're
was.
talking 50, 40, 50 years, right?
Yes, it was in the Cinemateca of Caracas. Yeah, and then it was incredible for Nora. Was like we sent her a picture. We made a Zoom and it surprised her sending a picture of the reels. So yes, they were in a very good condition. That it's very weird, right? Because in Venezuela there's a lot of instability, energy instability, not necessary in all Latin America, not only in Venezuela, in all Latin America, the conditions of preservation, it's not the ideal one. So for us it was very surprising.
That's really great, and it's great that it was in good condition. I worked on films where, for example, one time I had to go to the LA City Archives, the LAPD's some of the LAPD's archives are at the LA City Archives, and Chief Parker, who was chief of police during the Watts Rebellion, he was pretty awful, very racist, but he surveilled everything. So there are reels of footage in there that's like 40, 50, 60 years old that have never ever been like digitized. Like there's like footage of the one of the Soviet premieres, I think it's Khrushchev, like at Disney World, at Disneyland. There's footage in there like of Dr. King, like various speeches, Malcolm X. There's just sitting in boxes, but there's no money to like preserve it. Yes. There's no money to digitize it. But also, I'm going to talk about some of the things that you mentioned, Christy, in regards to the voices, because that aren't heard with archives. Because a lot of people, times we have this idea of like archives being objective. It is okay. Yes, the archives are primary sources, obviously. But what gets selected to be part of an archive is very subjective. And if a person or a story or a people are not deemed important, then that is not going to be preserved and it's going to be tossed. And that has happened. In 2022, as part of this Doc Live podcast series, I actually had a conversation with Jihan El Tari. And we talked about archives, particularly from the perspective of the global South. It was a really great conversation for me, but also challenging for me because it really challenged some, for me, some, I guess, some unacknowledged preconceived notions of archives and ownership. And Jihan was like really great in dismantling that. For me, it's like these are the peoples, because so much of archives in the US is like it's about licensing and who owns it and who gets paid for it and just all these things that really make it incredibly prohibitive for everyday folks to access. I just wanted to kind of like just go through some of the questions that Jihan and I talked about and see if y'all could speak to that in the context of what you're trying to do with searching for Nora. So some of the things we touch on, dismantling Western concepts of archive and ownership, archival preservations as assets for those who are part of the Global South, the question of what gets monetized in archives and how monetization makes assets prohibitive, the role that archivists play in the preservation of history, and access to non-commercial archives, which Christy, you alluded to with the box of photos that's under somebody's bed. So I know that was a lot, but if you can kind of speak to that in regards to working with this film and with Noor, as well as anything that's specific to like what's happening in Peru.
Well, in Peru, we don't have actually a place that we can apply from this from the government that preserve the archives. We have only one, but it's from from a private university, and so we don't have an ideal place. Actually, Nora, when we found Runan Kaiku, she said you don't have to bring her to Peru, bring it to Peru, because we don't have the conditions to have the reels. So yeah, it's very sad, but I think that happens not only in Peru, in different places in Latin America too, that don't have the conditions to preserve these archives, right?
It's the same in the US too. Universities will, people donate their materials to an archive and they'll just sit in a box in universities because they don't have the people or the bandwidth to catalog it, to even let people know what's in it. So
One thing we're trying to do, although we have limited means, but we're trying within our way of working, is to think through with Norda some of these questions and say, like, how do we want to act now, right? So one of them was, yes, so we found it in Venezuela. And well, we didn't, first of all, because we couldn't go to Venezuela, so we had to hire a crew, and they were trying to do some filming and they were trying to do some searching. When they found it, then we said, yeah, Nora, like, do you want it to come back? We talked to Saturnina's family, and we asked them, and what was important to everyone was seeing it and having a restored version. Okay, so then we went back to Venezuela and we said, and that was good, because honestly, to have some kind of agreement for this physical object to be able to move would have been very time consuming and costly. So we were able to secure the agreement that the archivists, you talked about the archivists, they were the gatekeepers here. And they said, because the Venezuelan Cinemateca had bought this from Nora in her house, like they bought these reels from her. That was how it originally was transferred and how people understood ownership at the time. So then we got permission for the reels to leave the building, the archive, and to be taken to Bolivar Films, which is one of the oldest studios in Caracas, because they already have an established relationship with the archive. And they were able to restore it, restore the film, because they already had a trusting relationship. And then they understood that Nora, as author, even though she used state funding, she was seen as the author of the film. And so intellectual property wise, I guess it made sense for everyone to send a digitized version to her. So we actually talked about like a digital repatriation, like a digitized version of this. It was like repatriating it to Peru, but not physically. And then once it's there, Nora also agreed that the same digitized copy goes to Saturnino's family. So Nora has it, and Saturnino's family has it. And we also wanted to make sure it was accessible to people. So we made it in different file formats. It's on a USB drive, which made sense. We also made physical printouts in a photo album for people if they couldn't have access to a computer. So really trying to think through that distribution of the material and who really does have a right to it, and trying to respect different ideas of that system.
Right. That's great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So tell us about Searching for Nora, the film. And you may have to change that title because it sounds like you've definitely found her.
Yes.
But what is like Searching for Nora? Is it a retrospective of her life and her influence, or is it a typical bio doc? Like what is the film?
All right. Well, we are exploring other titles. We have one we really like, but we're not ready to announce it. We are thinking of including something about films that we don't get to see. So this concept of whether it was lost or it was we it, someone prohibit us from seeing it, it was banned, something like that. We are trying to strike a balance between these two storylines of Nora's transformation from a mom into a filmmaker activist, something that starts small. In Lima, she gets divorced, but then she makes this Runan Kaiku film at the national level. But then it takes her to this international hemispheric movement of filmmakers using film as a tool for political and social change against right-wing dictatorships that was happening all in the hemisphere, and starting the first film school to diversify the voices in Latin American filmmaking and the world. So there's that.
There's that, yes.
And that spans from, just a little. That spans from Claudia, what is it, like 1967 to 1985, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yes.
And then you have this search, the contemporary search for the reels. And then this we the surprise finding. And then you have this digitization, because it raises so many questions about access to resources and whatnot, and then repatriation. And then it comes back to Peru and thinking, what does it mean today for it to come back now, given everything that's happening? And even for Saturnino's family, we have filmed some really meaningful, we believe, really meaningful moments that show the significance of this, and hopefully point to why these kinds of efforts are important to pursue.
And it's, I guess it's particularly important for his his family just to see him back in the day, you know, at a particular moment in his life, but also, I don't know if he has grandkids or great grandkids now, for them to see him as well.
Yes, totally. And of course, his family and also all the Peruvians, I think, because Runa and Kaiku is a film that today you can watch it and you said, like, oh my God, I can't believe that in 50 years, a lot of things are the same. A lot of problems that we had in the 70s, we continue, they're still today. You know, so yeah, I think we all have to watch that film because you can't like understand a little bit more your society, also trying to create a change.
So are you all looking for some of her other films as well? As part of this filmmaking process.
I think every other film she has been trying to track down and has quite a bit of success. I believe that Runen Kaiku was the last one, and she really doubted that she would find it because there were several copies, and so our search looks for the last three known copies, one of which was in Cuba, one of which was in Cusco, and one of which was in Venezuela. Yeah, I think that I lost my train of thought, so maybe we can edit
That's okay. It happens. So, as you're filming Nora, as she's going on this journey of, like, in a way, kind of rediscovering slash reclaiming her work, like, what story are you trying to tell from, like, that particular angle, particularly as she's a woman who's really reflecting on her life?
well. We are making this film not only because we admire Tunora, because she is a very positive representation of women in film. In Peru, there's a lot of inequality till today. It's getting better, but if you can see all the spectrum, you can see the inequalities also because the women that can make films in Peru, they're privileged women. If you don't have the resources, if you don't live in a capital, if you speak another language, maybe for you it's more difficult as a woman to make films. So we don't know. We always think about Nora as a really great person that you can watch her story and look for that kind of positive representation. You know, we are thinking also about our impact strategy
Okay, I can help you with that.
and we want to create these spaces for other women filmmakers or for other students that want to be filmmakers, and for other women that want only pursue a dream, you know, it's yes.
Well, I mean, looking at Nora's filmography, you know, she was seemed to be really committed to shooting and showcasing folks who we don't normally see. Obviously, those who have pronounced it Quechua. Okay, Quechua. But I saw in 1990 she did a film Color de Mujer, so that's about, you know, Afro-Peruvians. There's also another one. What is it? Oh, the Canción al viejo fisca que ateche en los lagos Amazonians. I'm working on my pronunciation. Which is about Fisca, who is an Apache fisherman from the Amazon. So a lot of her work centered these voices of folks we don't normally see. I'm assuming, like, in mainstream Peruvian culture. So that's. And even though this is when Anne first brought me the prospect of interviewing y'all, this is the first time I ever heard of Nora. Like, I was just really impressed by the breadth and depth of her work, you know, and really inspired by the fact that she wanted to She wants to see on screen what she did not normally see and wanted to uplift of that. There's a level of curiosity, but also cultural humility and respect that's there.
Yes, totally. She had a very important way or process to work with her subject, not only with Saturnino from Runankaiku, with other subjects. She had very like empathy and respect, and she went to live with Color de Mujer. I think she went to live like 2 months or 3 months with these families. So yeah, I think that's very, for us like document like filmmakers, it's very inspiring.
Yeah, she embedded
She
herself and very, very anthropological as well.
absolutely did. And she put into practice so many ethical considerations that people are talking about today in the 70s and 80s. And in that way, she was a pioneer, period, just in Peruvian film, in cinema history. She was phenomenal at building care into her filmmaking and conscientiousness. And she's a huge inspiration, I think, on many, many levels, because also she was doing this as a single mom of four kids. She is a powerhouse. She's really phenomenal. And we also wanted to show the depth of character, because we don't want to build her up as a flat heroine either. She's human with flaws and all kinds of, idiosyncrasies, just like anyone else.
Right. That ethics question is a conversation, as I'm sure you both know, that has been had a lot within the documentary space. And like personally, it's been a bit unsatisfactory for me because it's more of, it seems like to be like, oh, it's like ethics are kind of like, oh, like nice to have. But also, when you're talking about filmmakers who are not from a particular community, going into a community and shooting without the considerations and without the care, without the cultural humility and the harm that results from that. So there was a film that came out but 2 years ago called Subject, which is about that features documentary subjects. And it talked about the good things, but also talked about the bad things, particularly some things around like consent. And one initiative I'm working on, not so shameless plug, Represent Media Artworks Projects and Video Consortium on what will eventually be a field guide for filmmakers who are working with survivors of trauma that's not ethics based, but is trauma informed and human rights based. Because from a human rights perspective, if harm is experienced by a film participant, they can actually have some type of legal recourse. And one thing that's missing in regards to the doc space is the around the ethics is really the lack of accountability. And Nora, I mean, like you said, the level of care that she goes in with. I mean, the fact that I mean she's insisting on the family getting a copy of the digitized version. You don't normally hear that.
And even this last year at the film festival, when I mentioned that she was honored with an event and the festival was dedicated to her, they showed Color de Mujer, and that same family came with multiple generations and still, right, we're connecting with Nora and crying. And this was it was a beautiful moment. And it I am certain that Nora made mistakes, right? But to do what she did in the 70s and to see that over 50 years later, these relationships are still vibrant, and they're excited about what they did together, that is huge, I think.
Well, in the film Subject, I don't remember who said it, but they interview not only, the film subjects, but also filmmakers, but also like industry film folks. And it's one filmmaker, I remember he was a guy. He says, basically he does a film, he meets the film protagonist and then he's done. Whereas the and then they cut to a woman who says, yeah, I meet the film protagonist, and then I continue to engage with them over the years and check in and see how they're doing. So, and to me, like, filmmaking is very much, particularly documentary filmmaking, is very much about relationships, because you're going in with a camera into somebody's lives and asking them to open up their life to you. You have a level of responsibility and care that you need to bring to that relationship. It is not these stories to me aren't, they're not commodities, to be traded. And I think that concept needs to shift, because like I said, there's a level of responsibility, and also it makes for, I think, a more authentic filmmaking experience as well.
Totally, because it's a bond you create in the process. It's a bond you create before and after the process. It's
Yeah, and even if that relationship doesn't continue, because maybe it is for a season, just being very conscientious about how you treat people and the engagement, and also recognizing that sometimes people are sharing some of their most intimate moments with you, and just and honoring them and respecting them for that. So I feel like we, can learn a lot from Nora, which is one reason I'm very excited about your film, because I think we need models to show us that there are filmmakers who have always been engaging in this way. This ethics conversation, this conversation around care, is not new. There are people who have been doing this in interacting with the film participants in a particular in this way for a long time, and sometimes we're just catching up.
And to that end, then we discussed with some people when we were in Peru filming this last time again. And so why did it take so long for Nora to be recognized for this fantastic work? Why was the one of the most important films here? Why was it just lost and not sought after and digitized already, right? Why? So there, we think it's high time, and we hope that we can finish it, so that Nora can participate in the editing and the post-production and approve it, as something that she's proud of, because she really is the boss on this production, to be clear. And we work very closely with her, but she is 91, and we need to finish this so that she can see it. So we're really hoping that some funding will continue to come through, and we can do this in line with when she is able to participate with us.
Okay, so great segue. Okay, so where are y'all in the filmmaking process? When do you anticipate being done? How much money do you need? Top six.
Well, we are in production now. We filmed a lot through all these years, but we need to go to Cuba because Cuba is a very important part of this film. So we are looking for funding and to go to Cuba. So we are waiting for the Peruvian funds and other funds. So we are with our fingers crossed. And we want to finish our film in late 2025, but let's see what happens. We depend on funding, we depend on a lot of things, but we want to start the distribution at the beginning of 2026.
So I'm very specific when it comes to pitching. I actually coach people in pitching. So how much money do you need to get you to Cuba? And then what do you need, like, to get to the end? How much money do you need to get you to the end of production?
To go to Cuba, like $40,
Okay.
and for ending the production, almost like $200,000, not $200.
All right, yeah, it's good. I like specific numbers, so great. Okay.
We have filmed everything that we anticipate we will film with Nora. which a lot of people will ask about because she is 91. We've been filming with Nona since 2015.
Okay.
We did take a break for babies and dissertations and pandemics, but those are all great reasons to take a break. So Cuba and Peru, those are our last production trips, honestly. And then we would be in post, and we have an editor, a fantastic editor from Argentina, and we have already started building a great relationship with her. So it's
She's
looking
also okay. I'm sorry, she's also a mom.
Yes.
So it is true. We wanted to go to Cuba this year and we couldn't. So we are really hoping that something will come through with that 40 grand and we can go in the first part of the next year. And then with that, we can edit, and do post-production as quickly as any funding would allow us to.
Okay, so funders out there, you hear that they need money to go to Cuba beginning of 2025. So let's see if we can make that happen. All
Thank
right, so
you.
do either you have any final thoughts as we wrap up today?
Well, for me, thank you so much for the invitation. It's been very, very, very fun. I think we addressed some interesting topics. So thank you so much.
Yes, this is a total honor and it was very exciting. I'm really hopeful that we can finish this production, and then I would love to one day hear, if you see it, I'd love your feedback, and thank you so much for
Well, thank you both, first of all, for gracing the screen with this co-production between myself and Doc Leipzig. And then also thank you for introducing many of us for the first time to Nora. I think we as a film community can really learn a lot from her example, and I'm so glad that she is around because a lot of times, as we say in the US, people don't get their flowers until after they're gone. So, hopefully you all will get this done, but it's so great that she's been part of this process as well. So she knows this is happening because, we need to, those who have gone before us, we absolutely have to honor and respect them and then figure out ways to continue their legacy. So thank you.